Campsite Media.
The Binge.
I dated a woman for a while who would introduce me at dinner parties and at birthday parties and that sort of stuff as, "This is Jay, he got anthrax." Which would always lead to like a long story about what that was like.
That's Jay Carson. He would go on to work for the Clintons and Michael Bloomberg and become the inspiration for the main character in the movie The Ides of March. He also later created The Morning Show on Apple TV+. But back in 2001, Carson worked for South Dakota Senator Tom Daschle on Capitol Hill.
Strangely, doesn't that say something? The anthrax survivor has been more of a claim to fame than the fact that Ryan Gosling played me in a movie that George Clooney directed and co-starred in.
Jay was one of thousands of people who had their lives turned upside down by two anthrax letters sent to senators in D.C. in October 2001. Jay and his colleagues on the Hill, they were lucky. He can look back now and joke about it at parties over cocktails. But that doesn't tell the full story. Because the people who unknowingly handled and delivered those anthrax letters, those public servants who can't be stopped by neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night, well, they weren't so lucky. From Campsite Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up, the Anthrax Threat. Episode 2, A Tale of Two DCs. In the fall of 2001, after multiple letters appeared in New York, authorities on Capitol Hill were bracing for a possible anthrax attack.
Our office manager had told people not to answer the mail, that they were going to get a briefing to make sure that they could open the mail safely.
Laura Petru was legislative director for Tom Daschle, the senator from South Dakota.
And I remember being up there Friday afternoon, and for some reason, I remember seeing the stack of mail, because we talked about you're not going to open it yet, and it still had the string on top of it, tying it together.
Laura remembered seeing a small envelope at the top of the stack, addressed to Daschle, who at the time was the Senate Majority Leader and one of the most powerful people in the U.S. government. The handwriting on the envelope was sloppy and uneven, like it had been written by a child.
Yeah, it stuck out in my mind because it was from, I think it was from New Jersey, and it's had Greendale School on it, and, you know, we got mail from kids all the time. That was another thing. Tom Daschle wanted us to answer all the letters from kids. Oh my God, do you know how many kids write us?
The letter just sat there on top of the pile over the weekend until Monday, when the staff would be trained on how to safely open any suspicious mail. That day, Jay Carson was in the middle of a staff meeting when one of Daschle's senior advisors interrupted.
Eric Washburn politely knocks on the door, and it was quickly disseminated within the meeting that Grant Leslie had opened a letter upstairs.
The same letter that Laura had seen a few days earlier.
And there was a suspicion it had anthrax in it. And the Capitol Police are coming. They're going to do a field test on it. We said, oh, that's interesting.
Grant Leslie, the intern who'd opened the letter, had done everything she'd been trained to do the week before. She cut the tip off the corner of the envelope, and as soon as she saw powder leak out, she covered it with her finger and waited for the Capitol Police.
And we just went about our meeting. Agenda item 3, how should we roll out the South Dakota Economic Development Plan? Well, first we should go to Sioux Falls. I mean, like, nothing was happening.
The police didn't seem to take it all that seriously either.
There had been so many false alarms. You know, they came to our office not in hazmat suits. And because I think they got tired of putting them on and they didn't think it was going to be real.
Ever since Bob Stevens' death in Florida 10 days earlier, police had been flooded with thousands of false alarms about potential anthrax mail. If the threat happened to be on Capitol Hill, then Jim Rice, who led the FBI's crisis response unit, would get the call.
The D.C. Fire Department was getting so many calls about hazardous mail that they would no longer collect it and give it to us or give it to the police department. All fire trucks carried great big buckets of bleach. And if you called them, they went to your house and they took your mail and they stuck it in the bleach. I had a call from a member of Congress who said that he got a letter in the mail, and it was a very thick letter, and he was scared. I said, can you tell me what it looks like? He goes, yeah, it looks like a Christmas card from my mom. I said, is your mom still alive? I don't. He said, oh, yeah. I said, would you expect a Christmas card? Oh, she loves to send cards, sends me cards all the time. He said, I'm a congressman, and I got mail, and I want you to come get it. We had hundreds and hundreds of calls every day, you know, because everybody all of a sudden was scared of their mail.
Jeff Navin, Daschle's research director, remembers the Capitol Police arriving very clearly.
The Capitol Police arrived, and it was a plainclothes officer. No PPE, you know, no gloves, no mask, nothing. And the first thing they did was open the letter to read it. And when they did that, what was a very small leak of white powder turned into a big puff of anthrax.
The police had stocked up on field tests, or smart tickets, to distinguish hoaxes like baby powder or powdered sugar from the real deal. When they ran one of these smart tickets on the Daschle letter, red flags went up immediately.
And Eric politely knocks on the door again and says, hey, so the first field test has come back and it's positive.
When Jim got the update, he was still skeptical.
I said, okay, we're sending people your way. I said, but don't get too concerned or too wound up yet. I said, we've seen these smart tickets give us false positives in the past, so don't anybody panic yet. And he goes, no, we have done this test over and over and over again. It doesn't turn pink. It turns bright red as soon as we test it every single time. And I said, oh, that's new. That's never, ever happened before.
Now Jim was concerned, so he sent some of his top agents to the scene. Senator Daschle had an office in the Capitol building, but most of his staff worked in the Hart building, next door. And that office was split between two floors. The letter was opened upstairs, so everybody who worked there was evacuated and taken for treatment. But the people downstairs were not. Instead, they were called into a meeting.
There was a health official who came. They told us there is no chance that the anthrax could have spread downstairs. There's no chance it could have spread to beyond 6 feet past where the letter actually was. And so if you're downstairs, you're completely fine. I remember it being told as a definitive fact.
Admiral John Isold, the attending physician to Congress, came in to reassure the Daschle staff that they had nothing to worry about. Here's Jeff Navin again.
And there was this moment that I will never forget. There's a guy on our staff named Peter Hansen, son of a Lutheran minister, very sort of, you know, understated and soft-spoken. And he asks Admiral Isold what the process is to test to see whether or not you've been exposed to anthrax. So Admiral Isold says you take a nasal swab, which is essentially a long Q-tip, and you put it into your nose and move it around, and then you put it on a petri dish and you see if anything grows. And Peter says, I think we'd all feel more comfortable if we could just have that test. And Admiral Isold said, it would be a waste of Senate resources to swab you all. And here, there's like 30, 40 people in here. It's not like we're talking thousands of people. And Peter, in the very restrained way that, you know, he is, says, you know, with all due respect, Admiral, I handle appropriations for the Senate Majority Leader. You let me know how many Q-tips you need, and I'll make sure you get them. And there was this moment where you could see Isold reading the room and recognizing, you know, this is the Senate Majority Leader's staff. And he says, okay, fine.
Now, we couldn't confirm that John Isold told the group that it would be a waste of Senate resources to test staff, but many experts believed that anthrax spores couldn't spread through the air because the powder would stay put once it settled on a surface. But the next day, as investigators swabbed the building, it became clear that the experts were wrong.
It had not only gotten to the entirety of the interior of the Daschle office, down the stairs, around the corner, that it had gotten into the HVAC system, it had traveled over to other offices, it had done exactly what they said it couldn't possibly do.
Thousands of people had potentially been exposed. What followed was like something out of a Hollywood plague movie. Hazmat teams from the FBI, CDC, Coast Guard, and Marines swarmed the Capitol in moon suits.
About 10:30 this morning, my office opened a suspicious package.
The Hart Building was locked down immediately. Then the entire United States Congress was evacuated. As Senate Majority Leader, Tom Daschle had to field calls from his colleagues, who were now locked out of their offices.
He had senators screaming at him all day long.
Laura Petru again, Daschle's legislative director.
They wanted to get back into their offices. I mean, literally one guy said, my Christmas list is on my desk and I need to go get it. Another senator said he needed to go and feed his fish. Have a little bit more empathy for the fish than the Christmas list, but I also think he sent a staffer in to feed his fish.
Meanwhile, Jay and Jeff were still waiting for the results from their nasal swabs. Then, early one morning, Jay was woken up by a call from his boss.
And the conversation went pretty much like this. Hey, Jay, good morning. Actually, he didn't even say good morning. Hey, Jay, I got some bad news for you, but you got anthrax.
All of Daschle's staffers were called into a meeting and informed that more than one person had tested positive.
I raise my hand and then I say, well, how are you going to be notified if you're one of these people? And they said, well, if you haven't heard already, then you tested negative. We've contacted everybody who tested positive, except one. And that turned out to be me.
Anyone who tested positive was put on antibiotics for 100 days. But there was still no guarantee they would survive. Laura remembers meeting with a Capitol Health official weeks after the letter was opened.
He sat me down and just said, a few of these people have several thousand lethal doses of anthrax in their noses. And he said, I am very concerned because it's going to take a very, very long time for all of that anthrax to be cleared from their system.
Laura was told that antibiotics might not be enough. Some of her colleagues would need an anthrax vaccine. Unfortunately, there was only one supply available, and it was reserved for the military.
We had, I think, all sort of thought we had gotten past the critical point. And that's when I knew he was still worried that they might die.
After weeks of negotiation, the FDA gave officials permission to use that vaccine. Laura said she washed the staff's contaminated clothes herself to make people feel more secure. And on the day they finally received the vaccine shot, she baked cakes to celebrate. And in the end, no one on Capitol Hill died. But the psychological effects would linger, even two decades later.
I noticed several years ago that I had some issues that I couldn't explain away. And I started to see a trauma therapist. And as I started to tell these stories, the two experiences back to back, right? 9/11 and then 5 weeks later, anthrax in my office had just given it like an underlying foundation of fear and insecurity and sort of when's the floor going to drop out. It's not a hoax in the letter. It's anthrax, right? It's not a commuter plane. It's a jumbo jet piloted by terrorists. It's not a man with a fake gun. It's a guy in the trunk of his car shooting. It was always the worst version in my brain just to started deciding that was what it was.
You know, I do think a lot about what would have happened if Peter had those concerns, but he didn't raise his hand. I'm very clear that we were able to get that reaction over the objections of the doctors only because of the agency that we had in that particular moment.
If they hadn't won that argument, who knows what would have happened.
Laura and her colleagues had the power to demand that authorities provide proper testing and treatment. But they recognized that not everyone affected by the attacks had that same privilege.
The experience that we had as Senate staffers, almost all white, was the complete opposite of the experience that the postal workers had, almost all black, right? That they couldn't get the Postal Service, they couldn't get their bosses, they couldn't get anybody to take it seriously. And people died, and people had their lives completely upended and ruined by that process because they weren't listened to.
One letter filled with anthrax had landed on Senator Tom Daschle's desk and shut down an entire branch of government for 8 days, making the anthrax mailings the FBI's highest priority. Now they had to consider another terrifying question. Were there other lethal letters on Capitol Hill? It was Jim Rice's job to answer that question. His domestic response squad deployed to the Capitol to collect every piece of mail they could find. They stuffed the mail into trash bags and planned to test it all for anthrax spores.
And then after we collected it, we had the problem, where are we going to sort this?
Good question. Where do you go to sort 280 barrels of potentially biohazardous mail? The FBI didn't have a space for that. Actually, no one did.
We were seriously thinking about buying a barge, set up a facility on top of the barge out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, test everything there, and then have the military, once we're done, sink the barge. And that was a serious consideration because we were running out of options.
Eventually, they found a warehouse equipped for the job in Springfield, Virginia, just about 30 minutes outside of D.C.
Do you remember the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where, you know, at the end of the movie where they put the ark in the big box and they nail it shut and they put it in this big warehouse that goes on forever? Okay, those things really exist. I've seen them. That place really does exist. And this was one of those type of facilities.
They spent the next few weeks looking for a needle in a mail stack.
And they finally found the letter. And it was an exact match for the Brokaw letter and the Daschle letter.
This letter was addressed to Patrick Leahy, the senator from Vermont.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant. I want to thank you and, of course, Capitol Police and you, sir. And I'm hoping that the one bright light in all of this might be that this letter will give us further evidence to find out who is doing this.
The Daschle letter and the Leahy letter had something in common. They both passed through the same post office, the Brentwood Mail Center, which processed mail for a huge portion of D.C., including everyone on Capitol Hill. Despite all the missteps by Capitol Police and health officials, Congress had dodged a bullet. Thanks to outspoken and influential people, the Hart Building was evacuated, people were tested, and given the treatment they needed. But the story at Brentwood was completely different.
And I want to thank you for joining us here today at the Postal Service's Washington, D.C. Processing and Distribution Center. As you know, one letter contained anthrax, and there is only a minute chance that anthrax spores escaped from it into this facility.
That's Jack Potter, who was Postmaster General back in 2001. A few days after the Capitol was shut down, he gave a press conference inside the Brentwood facility. Standing behind Potter are a handful of Brentwood's employees.
Our primary concern is the safety of the 2,000 employees who work here, and behind me are some of those employees who work in this facility.
So they will be given tested for people on Capitol Hill are?
A journalist in the crowd asks, will mail carriers be given the same tests as people on Capitol Hill were? Potter fumbles for a bit until Ken Weaver, the head of the Postal Inspection Service, steps in to clarify.
Well, the employees have not been tested. It's been my understanding, once the Department of Health determines that there has been exposure by an employee, the testings do occur then.
What Weaver is saying is that unlike the staff in Senator Daschle's office, Brentwood employees would not be tested for anthrax exposure, unless it was confirmed that an employee was already sick. In other words, they would only get help after it was too late. Before the press conference concludes, John Walsh, the host of America's Most Wanted, announced $1 million reward for any information leading to the arrest of the anthrax killer.
And thank you to the FBI, the Postal Service, and again to their brave employees. They know they've got a job to do, they know their lives are at risk, but they're here, they're going to deliver the mail, they're not going to let these cowards paralyze this country. Absolutely not.
This is something Americans heard a lot back then. Keep going back to work, keep shopping. Don't let the terrorists win. But workers at Brentwood got a different message.
They didn't put it like that. They didn't say the terrorists win. They said that you won't have a job.
That's a postal worker we spoke with who worked at Brentwood back in 2001. We're not using his name because he's still worried that talking about the anthrax attacks could cost him his job. even after all these years.
Because we didn't want to come back in this building. We didn't want to come back in here, but that still didn't say that what was in the building was safe for us to come back in here. They didn't say anything about that.
We were calling for them to shut the building down.
Terrell Worrell was also a postal worker back in 2001. He's since retired.
And the manager said, no, we're not going to shut the buildings down, because he basically said it costs $500,000 a day if we shut the building down. And so basically, that's dehumanizing. You're telling us that we're not worth $500,000.
On the very same day as the press conference, while the postmaster was telling the country that everything was perfectly fine, Terrell noticed that a hazmat team in white protective suits was swabbing the facility. He remembers what his boss told him.
He just said, stay out of the way of these men, you know, in these moon suits. Just stay out of the way and let them do their jobs. And I actually saw them in their hazmat gear walking around, you know. And it's surreal. It's surreal that we have regular clothes on and they have hazmat gear on. That's surreal. And at the end of the night, like you notice, I had glasses on. At the end of the night, my glasses had a film of dust on them.
Masks were handed out to Brentwood employees, but they were the cheap paper kind, and Terrell didn't trust that they'd keep him safe.
I call the number that was on the box of the masks that they gave us, and I said, are these masks safe in protection against anthrax? And they said, no.
At both the Hart Senate Building and at Brentwood, officials made decisions based on mistaken assumptions. At Hart, they'd assumed that anthrax wouldn't spread through the air. But when that was disproven, quick action was taken to protect the Senate staffers. Now, at Brentwood, they were claiming the anthrax spores couldn't pass through the fibers of a sealed envelope, even though the CDC had evidence showing this wasn't the case. Without the power of the Senate Majority Leader behind them, Brentwood workers were forced to gamble with their health. The facility did not close. It just kept sorting mail. The disparity between the way Capitol Hill staffers and the Brentwood mail workers were treated went beyond tragedy. It was farce. Even Saturday Night Live got in on the joke.
From the National Institute of Health is Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Thank you. We have cleaned the State Department, the White House, the Supreme Court, and the Capitol building with state-of-the-art decontamination instruments, and are installing dozens of $20 million irradiation lasers to keep all dangerous substances away from the U.S. government. Yes.
What about the post offices?
We've given each post office some baby wipes and a dustbuster.
Workers at Brentwood had a pretty good guess as to why they were treated differently.
Well, this is, I guess you'd say, predominantly black post office. If there was more white poor folks in here, then maybe they probably would have done something different.
Like, say, when you go up to human resources and you see white people, and then you go and you start working, but everybody in your section may be black except for maybe one person. It's not until after a couple of years that something hit me one day, and it just hit me, and I was like, where are the white people?
Terrell's pointing out the literal upstairs-downstairs dynamic at Brentwood. Management worked upstairs in sealed offices, and they were almost entirely white. The mail handlers worked downstairs in the mail processing warehouse, and they were almost entirely black.
You know, my mother had worked there before. My stepfather worked there. I've never heard nothing bad about the Postal Service.
Dina Briscoe was another Brentwood veteran at the time of the anthrax attacks. She'd started working there after college to support her son.
I mean, it's like, as an African-American, you feel like now you have kind of arrived. It just felt like you've kind of made it, because now you're going to be a part of the government.
But now that Dina was seeing up close just how the government was handling her safety, it started chipping away at the trust and pride she once felt. When Dina and some coworkers started getting headaches and feeling short of breath, they began to make demands.
So the supervisor took the three of us to the hospital. They do different tests.
When Dina finished the test that morning and came back into the waiting room, that supervisor was gone.
So I ended up walking from Providence Hospital back to Brentwood.
How far away is it?
That's another of our producers, Emil Klein.
It's probably about 4 miles or so.
Wait, you walked 4 miles after being taken to the hospital because...
They left. She left us. She left us.
The CDC began their investigation of Brentwood on October 20th, but it was too late. A postal worker named Thomas Morris Jr. had become sick. He was hospitalized with a confirmed case of inhalational anthrax.
One morning, Thomas woke me up and said that something was really wrong.
That's Thomas Morris Jr.'s wife, Mary, in a StoryCorps interview recorded in 2011.
I expected him to come back home, but that wasn't to be the case.
Thomas Morris Jr. died on October 21st at the age of 55. Joseph Kersine, another postal worker, died the next day. He was 47.
Well, that night, he was very sick, coughing real bad. And I was trying to figure out why he in here. I said, well, you should have stayed home. You shouldn't be here coughing like that. But he did. He was in there. He was faithfully every day doing what he do.
Finally, only after two of its workers inhaled anthrax and died, Brentwood was shut down. The building was cleared out and disinfected, and workers were given tests and life-saving antibiotics. In her interview, Mary said that she missed her husband deeply. But when she thought about all those people going in and out of the Brentwood post office, and only two dying...
That was nothing but the grace of God.
If you go to Brentwood today, you'll see two marble benches and a plaque by the front door, etched with the faces of Kersine and Morris. It says, "These unspeakably tragic events served as a defining moment for the Postal Service. The use of the mail stream for these despicable acts threatened all Americans. By weathering the storm and by ultimately returning the nation to a sense of normalcy, Postal Service employees became quiet heroes to all of our country."
They tell us, oh, you're heroes. You're heroes. But they set you on the front lines of a weapon with gloves that don't work and a mask that doesn't work. And then when you get sick, oh, he was a hero. No. A hero walks down the street, sees a burning building, and says, I have a choice. Let me run in there and save that child that's looking out the window. That's what a hero does. But what they did, they put us in the building that was on fire and said, you guys are heroes. You know? And it's, a hero has a choice. They didn't give us a choice.
In the months after the attacks, Terrell and Dina formed an advocacy group to fight for the rights of Brentwood employees, called Brentwood Exposed, and even filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Postal Service for the health problems they had suffered. The case was dismissed by a federal district court. When the Brentwood facility finally reopened in 2003, it was renamed the Joseph Kersine Jr. and Thomas Morris Jr. Processing and Distribution Center.
Oh, who doesn't want a building named after them? My thing is, they called them heroes and stuff because they're still trying to slither away from accountability. And you name a building after them, or let's give them a stamp and let's do this. But you could have kept them alive if you had just been honest.
Between October 5th and November 21st, 2001, five people died from anthrax inhalation. First was Bob Stevens in Florida, then Joseph Morris Jr. and Thomas Kersine Jr. at Brentwood. The last two people killed were Kathy Nguyen, age 61, a clerk who worked at a Manhattan hospital, and Audalie Lundgren, a 94-year-old woman in Connecticut. To this day, it's unclear exactly how either of these women were infected. The best guess is that some of their mail had been cross-contaminated by the anthrax letters, and that was all it took, just a few microscopic spores. And then, the attacks were over. No more letters would be sent or received. And the FBI had no good leads or suspects. the shockwave of fear and tragedy lingered. But it sure didn't take long for politicians and pundits to exploit that fear and turn it towards the easiest target, enemies overseas.
There may be some possible link. We have no hard data yet, but it's clear that Mr. Bin Laden is a man who's an evil man. He and his spokesman are openly bragging about how they hope to inflict more pain on our country. So we're watching every piece of evidence. We're making sure that we're connecting any dots that we have to find out who's doing this.
Next time on Cover Up, the Anthrax Threat.
My secretary came in and said, there are four gentlemen to see you. And I just invited them in, and then they had an interview with me for about 4.5 hours. They started, you know, again, how did you come? And do you have some information about 9/11? I said, what? Excuse me?
Cover Up, the Anthrax Threat is hosted by me, Josh Dean. The series was created and produced by Ben Robbins. It was written by Rajiv Gola. Our senior producer is Emil Klein. Additional production by Abhikar Adan and Natalia Winkleman. Emily Martinez is our story editor and executive producer. Our theme song was created by Ira Wolf Tootin. Sound design by Ewan Leitremuen and Bart Warshaw, with support from Emil Klein. The series was fact-checked by Jordan Reed and Callie Hitchcock. Special thanks to David Shin and Sue Zizza at Radio Wave Studios. And also to our operations team, Doug Slaywin, Ashley Warren, and Destiny Dingle. Campside's executive producers are me, Josh Dean, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Adam Hoff, and Matt Scher. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps other listeners find the show. And maybe recommend it to a friend while you're at it. Thanks for listening. See you next time.